This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Can you hear me in the back? My name is Kokyo, and I'm coming up from the lowlands of Santa Cruz. To meet you on the mountain in the spring. Good to see you all. I'd like to bring up an old Zen story. One of our Zen ancestors in ancient China was named Dongshan. In Japanese, we call him Tozan Ryokai. And the toe of his name is the toe of Soto, which is this particular lineage of Zen. So he's like our personal ancestor in this Zen lineage, Tozan or Dongshan. We have this big toe, part of our family. So, one time, in a land far, far away, Dongshan was walking along with his Dharma brother Sung Mi, and suddenly a white rabbit leapt across the path in front of him, and Sung Mi said, "Swift!" Quick. And as often in these stories, something's happening, but they're using the situation to discuss their understanding of Zen practice. And some of you might have heard that Zen is sometimes considered like a sudden path. There's gradual paths of Buddhism where you work on practice over a long time, you develop yourself as a person, and after a long, long time, maybe even eons, you become a Buddha. But Zen, part of the trademark style of Zen, sometimes within Zen they talk about sudden and gradual too, but in general, Zen as a particular manifestation of Buddhism is considered like a quick, sudden path to Buddha. So I think that's what they use this occasion of the rabbit leaping across the path to kind of discuss with each other their understanding of what it means to be the sudden school. So they're walking along the path, a white rabbit jumps across, and Sung Mi says, "Swift!" And friend Dongshan says, "How so? Like, let's get into it. What do we mean by sudden or swift?" And Sung Mi says, "It's like a ordinary commoner instantly promoted to prime minister." And we might hear about this Sutton School and think of it like this, that us ordinary commoners can have this realization where we suddenly become like the prime minister, the governor, the president, instantly, without like going through a whole education process and working our way up the ladder. Swift, how so? Like a commoner suddenly, instantly becoming prime minister. And Dongshan, our ancestor Dongshan, says to his friend Sunmi, a venerable old person like you, and still you speak this way? And friend Sunmi says, well, how would you say it, brother? Mm-hmm. And Dongshan says, after generations of nobility temporarily falling into poverty. And that's today's Zen story. Instead of the poor commoner instantly becoming prime minister, sounds like kind of the other way around, right? After many generations of nobility in the royal family, temporarily, we've fallen into this common poverty. That's how they talked in the old days. But you can see there's our ancestor Dongshan's trying to refine our understanding of this swiftness. What is this sudden awakening? Do you see how it's kind of like looking at it from a different perspective? Like the commoner being suddenly promoted to prime minister, we hear about that kind of thing and we think, yeah, that's what we would like that. We would like to have that instant promotion. And we have this idea about the prime minister is some, this royalty is this great status, this great state of being that we'd like to have as soon as possible. Why, if there's a sudden school, why would we bother with gradual? So we think that we're the status quo is this commoner, and then we become this special Buddha. But we're not quite sure what that is. So it may be that this very type of thinking is not so helpful. Maybe more helpful to look at it like after many generations, maybe we could even say infinite generations, we've always been royalty, but we temporarily have forgotten this and feel as if we're poor nobodies. So another kind of modern saying I've heard, I don't know where it comes from, but it's something like, it's not that we are human beings that have temporary spiritual experiences. It's that we're spiritual beings that are temporarily having a human experience. I think that's a modern version of the same story. It's not that we're human beings, it's really who we are, and we have some kind of temporary, extraordinary spiritual experience that goes beyond the human, even. We might think of it that way sometimes, but really it's more like we're spiritual beings. We're not actually really human beings. We're spiritual beings that are temporarily having a human experience. Temporarily, like right now, and maybe since we were born, it seems like we've been having this temporary human experience. But maybe that's not really who we are. So after generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty, I think that Dungshan here is referring to a story, another story, from one of our Indian sutras of the Buddha called the Lotus Sutra. The lotus of the wondrous Dharma, great vehicle, scripture. And there's many stories and parables in this amazing sutra. And maybe my favorite one is this story that I think Dungshan is referring to. This parable. And this parable, there's a king, like, who has been in this royal family for generations of nobility. A wealthy, powerful king who has this one son. And one day, I think the sutra actually says, the son, when he's very young child, runs away from home. So sometimes I've heard it sort of, maybe in modern tellings of this story, sometimes people might say, the son got lost, like in a busy marketplace. It makes maybe more sense that a young child could wander off in a busy marketplace and actually parents couldn't find him again. But actually the sutra says he ran away. For some reason, it doesn't say why. And in this parable, you maybe can tell where it's going from the beginning. That the king is like a Buddha, and this child is like us. Do we get lost from Buddha, or do we run away from Buddha? I think, why would I ever run away from Buddha? But maybe it's like, run away kind of implies it's our choice, right? That we're deciding to leave Buddha. So some people might say it like that. Some might even say to be born into the human realm and forget that we are actually Buddha is kind of like a choice. And some say, well, I didn't choose to be born here. At any rate, this child gets separated from his father, the king, and is so, I picture like almost like an infant, so small that doesn't remember where he lived and can't find his way back, but maybe people take care of him temporarily. It doesn't explain all this, but I think he doesn't get adopted or anything. He basically becomes destitute, homeless, and as he grows older. And then the king moves to another town. The king, of course, is totally distraught that he lost his only son, but moves to a new castle in another city. So now, even if the child were to remember where he came from, he went back there, Buddha, the king wouldn't be there anymore. He's now in a new town. And the kid's now like a teenager and a destitute, homeless, penniless beggar trying to just survive day to day, and wandering around, and happens one day to come into the town, the new town where the king lives on his begging rounds, and sees this huge palace and all the, you know, vast parkland all around, and is a little bit scared. It's a ritzy neighborhood for this beggar, and he's like, even being in this neighborhood, you know, the cops might stop to question me. I really don't. Yeah, this is not my type of place. I feel a little guilty even being in the neighborhood of this king, or this super wealthy owner of this mansion. And then sure enough, some people start coming towards him because the king up on his rooftop, sunbathing deck, looks down and is amazed to see, he recognizes his son, even though he's all disheveled and ragged. I can't believe it. I never thought this would happen. That my son would actually come into the area. There he is. Quick, go get him and bring him home, he says to his attendants. And so they run down there to get him, and of course the son starts running away. He's like, this was what I was hoping wouldn't happen. I gotta get out of here. And he's running, and they grab him, and they kind of like have to sort of drag him back to the palace, and he's struggling to they kind of lock him in a room, and he's banging on the door like, I'm innocent, I didn't do anything, I'll leave as soon as I can. And the king sees this from afar and says, I he's here, but actually it's not gonna work like this. I think, unfortunately, he feels he's so far away from this, I can't just like tell him he's my son. He'd think it's a ploy or something. So I have to actually come up with another kind of ploy. I have to come up with some skillful means. The sutra is a lot about how the Buddhas use skillful means to help awaken people. You can't just tell people that they're Buddha. I mean, you can, and sometimes we try, but they're like, cool, yeah, I'm Buddha. It's like, doesn't have that big an impact, right? Doesn't really work. It's not like an actual awakening just by hearing that. Maybe a little bit. The more we understand what it is, the more we can start to open to it. But still, we're the kind of like, yeah, but I'm not like the Buddhas, like Shakyamuni Buddha. I'm just not. So the king's skillful means is, he's like, in a way, this skillful means in this story seem like it's kind of like getting in, like, he's not going to get this sudden thing of drag him back to the palace. Let's do some gradual practice for him to warm up to this truth that he actually is royalty. So for this gradual practice, instead of just dragging him back to the palace, we'll send down maybe some different attendants that he won't recognize. And instead of being dressed up in the spiffy suits of the palace, they're gonna like, they can dress kind of ragged too, and say, we'll hire you for a kind of a lowly job if you like. Since you're homeless, you can do something kind of lowly, like we have this stable where we need to shovel a lot of manure, and we'll hire you, not for very much, but a little bit, we'll hire you. And because maybe if they offer too much, you'd be like, this doesn't seem right. But like a little bit, we'll hire you for very low, below minimum wage. And he was like, yeah, that's great. I'm just a beggar. I'm happy to work below minimum wage and shovel manure. I've never had a job, actually. So he agrees. Skillful means is working. And he starts, you know, in the outskirts of the palace grounds, there's the horse stables, and he works shoveling the manure, which you could see as like the gradual practice of our own stuff, right? Is like we have to sift through it a lot. This is the gradual path. I have all of these defilements. I have all of these basically greed, hate, and delusion. I can't be a Buddha if I'm just filled with greed, hate, and delusion. So let's like shovel this stuff. Let's work with it. Let's slowly and gradually, like by the scoopful, move it out. And he's good at this job, and he feels like he can do it well, and he does it for a while, and then the king, of course, is watching all this, and say, well, how about, like, let's give him a raise. The same work, but, you know, give him a raise, and he's, like, up for that now. He's, like, he's, in a way, he's building up confidence, right? He's like, I maybe deserve a raise now, because I'm a good manure shoveler. So slowly, slowly, and occasionally the king, who's like so happy that he's here, but feels so sorry for him, in a way, just shoveling the manure there, occasionally the king himself puts on rags and dirties himself up and shovels manure with him. And I think the sutra says, it's very long, pages and pages of this parable. It's beautiful. Chapter 4 of the Lotus Sutra, if you'd like to read sometime. I think King says, when he goes down into the work in the stables, sometimes he says, good job, you're doing great. And sometimes he kind of admonishes him, like, work a little quicker here. It's like, as his sort of teacher, sometimes a little bit strict and sometimes a little bit, you know, giving and generous. And eventually he gets promoted, like, you've been doing so well and you're such a diligent worker and you're never late to work. So why don't you, like, we actually need some other help now besides just stable work. Could you kind of come inside and, you know, do some bookkeeping for us? We'll help teach you how. You're a loyal worker. So at this point, that probably wouldn't have worked at first to just be a bookkeeper. But at this point, he's like, okay, I can learn bookkeeping. Gradually. And the sutra says he starts more and more learning about the accounts of the king. Like now we're kind of, he's getting promoted more and more, and the kind of inner workings of the king's business. He never thought this would happen, but gradually he's more and more up for it. He just keeps getting promoted more and more till he's basically like the king's main assistant, helping run the whole business of the king. And then one day the king finally decides it's time to break the news to his son and say, actually, I'm getting old and I need somebody to take on the family business. And in fact, you are my actual true son. You can have everything now. The son's probably a bit surprised, but not totally freaked out for this point. He's like, in a way, the fact that he's the king's son maybe doesn't make that much difference now, because he's basically living as the king's son already. So the fact that you actually are the king's son, he's like, okay, that's cool, but even if I wasn't, I'm still going to inherit your business. I didn't think you had a son at all. I'm actually your blood lineage son. All the better. All the more wonderful. So that's the parable of the Lotus Sutra. And that's what our Zen ancestor Dungshan refers to when speaking about the sudden, interestingly, about the sudden, swift path of our lineage. It's not really like a commoner instantly becoming a prime minister. It's more like after generations of nobility already being royalty, temporarily forgetting and falling into poverty. We might say there's a gradual process, maybe for most people, a gradual process of developing confidence in our royalty. But we could even say in this story, there was a sudden moment, right? There was a particular moment when the king said, actually, you are royalty. You are my actual true son. But by the time the sudden realization happened, it wasn't a very big deal. Okay. I totally accept it now, and it's not so shocking really at this point. So I think these are sweet stories. Of course, it brings up the question of what is this nobility, actually? What is this royalty? That's why to tell somebody, you know, you are already Buddha. It's so abstract. You are noble royalty. What does it actually mean? And even if we talk about it, usually we have a hard time fully accepting it. Or even if we get a little taste and a little bit of trust, we quickly forget it because of our habits. By the way, the name of this chapter 4 in the Lotus Sutra, is just this whole parable, is called Trust and Understanding. It's the name of the chapter. That's nice, I think, because it's basically, he's just coming to, or you could translate it as faith and understanding, or even faith and liberation. But it's like, I like the word trust, because it's like, it's no longer, I have faith that I'm Buddha, it's more than faith, we might say. It's like, faith might be like, I have a sense that it's true. That's how I think of the word faith. But trust is like, I know it's true. So trust and understanding. How can we trust this and trust this more and more? In fact, my teacher Tenzin Roshi, I was at a talk of his last week or so, and somehow the nugget that came out of that talk that I remember is we talk about forgetting. I talk about forgetting and think about. In a way, that's like this sun is where we can remember at times our true nature, but then we forget most of the time. And my teacher said something like, it's not really that we forget our true nature. It's forgetting is basically not trusting our true nature. I thought that was a great teaching for me. It's not like we really do trust it, but then we forget it. I think this new understanding is at the time we forget it, which may be like most of the time, going about our human life and with our attachments and aversions and so on. It's not that we're forgetting, or we could say what our forgetting is that we don't really trust. If we trusted 100% that we're Buddha, we would not forget. We would never forget. I like this teaching. From my own life, I feel like this One example of this gradual story for me is hearing the teachings of the ancestors. So, like, in college, I took a Zen class. Over 30 years ago, there was a Zen class in my university, and I was just getting into Zen practice. Part of this class kind of helped inspire me to get into actual sitting Zazen at that time. But I remember in this class, we had like some textbooks. I think it was kind of specific. It was like early Chinese Chan Zen class. So the syllabus was like the Platform Sutra of the Six Ancestor and the record of Huangbo and Baijiang and Linji. I think we read all those in class, and I still have some old Xerox copies from this class. And I remember reading those, and like little bits and pieces were like, wow, this is cool, and these people talked weird. But like only little bits and pieces. Something was inspiring enough to get me to actually start practicing. But I think a lot of it was like, it sounded good, and on some level I kind of got it. But then, you know, years later, I pick up those books, those same records of these old ancestors, and be like, a light would be like radiating off the page. I'm like, amazing! I like forgot it. They said this stuff. It's like so direct and so clear and like, and so beautiful, and it makes so much more sense. And so in a way, it's like the same thing was there, but like gradually after a lot of Zazen practice and hearing other teachings, the same words like had this new life. And even still, you know, even in the last 5 years, there's things that I'll pick up that I come back to again and again, some of these teachings, and it's new layers are there. It's like, even talking about this Lotus Sutra story, I think I probably heard that over 20 years ago, and I thought it was a cool story, but as it strikes me today, I feel like it's even more amazing. But there's layers there that I didn't appreciate before. I still, I think, have some manure shoveling to do. That will maybe I'll appreciate this story even more in the future. But what is this royalty? So just to mention a little bit, and you know, it probably won't have such an impact because it's just words. But if I had to say something about the commoner and the royalty, or the lost son and the king, I would say something like, it's kind of who we think we are. This story is about who we think we are, right? And our Buddha nature is who we really are. And one way of looking at Buddha nature would be like, this very awareness is present right now, and this very awareness that's present right now is, if we settle into it very intimately and explore it very carefully, we can come to see that all experiences that are happening to us are happening in this awareness. Like there's an experience of the body, and the body is these sensations that are constantly changing in different parts of the body. They're sensations of tightness or relaxation, we call physical sensations. But are they not happening in the space of awareness? You could say awareness knows them, but if awareness is like this big space, a big knowing, cognizing space, and within the space is appearing sensations, physical sensations. So, in other words, what we call the body experientially, the experience of the body, is happening in awareness. Usually, I think our habitual mode is we are a body, and awareness is happening in me, the body. That's more like a common sort of materialist understanding, right? We've heard that like somehow consciousness is connected with the brain, and we sometimes feel like our perception is even like, I am a body. We identify with the body as myself, and inside it, there's some kind of knowing consciousness. But I would propose if we explore our experience really intimately, we can open to how I am actually this awareness. Even when we say, I have a body. It's like a normal thing to say. We could say this awareness has an experience called a body. But then when we think about it, if we were asked to describe it, it's more like, no, it's more like awareness is in the body. But maybe our language sometimes reveals what's more true, really. Who is this I that has a body and that feels like it's always the same? Could it be our Buddha nature that doesn't change, like space doesn't change, but space, all kinds of experiences can happen in the space. And thoughts and feelings, we could say, are arising and ceasing in the space of awareness, out of the space of awareness. Dare we even say, made of the space of awareness. So if this space is like the royal nobility, it temporarily falls into poverty when we, instead of identifying ourselves with the space, we identify ourselves with a body and thoughts and feelings. It's like we temporarily fall into this destitution of being a limited body and mind which was born and is going to die pretty soon. And how destitute, how impoverished. There is an experience of the body and thoughts and feelings. But is that our true nature? Is that our true identity? So, that's the story for today. Do you have any comments or questions? Yes.
In the long chant that we did earlier, which I understand is called the Sandokan.
Oh, yes.
Can we find this teaching?
Yes, yeah. So there's a lot of imagery of dark and light in there, right? Right in light there is darkness. And right in darkness there is light. And in that, the poetry of that poem, it's usually understood that darkness is actually like the royal nobility. This is one way to look at this anyway. It's like the vast space, like when we look at night, when we look into vast space, it's just dark, right? And then, but within that vast space, things appear like stars and planets. Little bits of light appear in that darkness. Those are like experiences of thoughts and sensations and perceptions and that are coming and going, blinking on and off in the big dark space. So right in darkness there is light. But I think that the poem says something, but don't see it as light. Right in light there is darkness, but don't confront it as darkness. So if we went up close to one of those stars in the sky, if we went right up close to it and saw it as, and or let's say a planet. We land on that planet, and we're on this planet. Let's say right on in this light planet, there's actually is darkness. In terms of maybe in our experience, we could say the sensation of the body is something that's it's an experience. It's a light experience. It's something that we can see. That's where we say light. So there's a sensation in the stomach or something like that. But right in this light sensation, there's actually darkness. It means like it's actually made out of the space that it's appearing in. But then the poem says, but don't confront it as darkness. Don't just say, this sensation in my stomach is just empty space. It's like we can say, let's have lunch or feed it. You know, don't confront, don't just say, it's just emptiness. Even though it is. Right in this light there is darkness. And right in the darkness there is light. But from the perspective of the darkness, we're emphasizing the darkness, and from the perspective of light, we're emphasizing the light. That's one way to get that Sandokai. Which is called Sandokai, we sometimes translate as merging of difference and unity, or the harmony of difference and equality. And you could say this light and dark are not really two different realms. And the Lotus Sutra brings that out nicely, right? It's like the poor son and the royal nobility are not two different things. That same person is the poor son and their noble royalty simultaneously. They don't have to become royalty because they already are, but they maybe do have to spend some time developing trust in that, in who they really are. Yes.
I really enjoyed your parable, and also it was interesting to me the way that helped to explain what's distinctive about Zen, mm-hmm. and that there's an awakening, but it's prepared. And this morning I was listening a little bit for the first time to Ajahn Brahm, and he was saying, somebody had asked him, what's the difference between Theravada and Mahayana and Zen? And he said, on the surface they appear different, but underlying is the same. And that story was very much, that is the long path. It just ends with a discovery.
Yeah.
And it seemed the same, only with a different emphasis.
Yeah. I mean, if we're really talking about our true nature, if it's really our true nature, there couldn't really be different versions of it. But there could be different descriptions of it and different ways of speaking about it. And then there could be details that where people argue about what exactly is our true nature. And within Buddhism, I think we could say the basics are definitely the same. It's all one family. And then I think it's kind of beautiful that within that big family we can discuss subtle differences in order to refine our own understanding and experience in life. Not even so much necessarily that there's a better or worse one. We can fall into that trap, but more like by discussing different points of view, we can clarify our own experience more deeply, which in a way is like the story of Dungshan and his Dharma brother, Sung Mi, had slightly different, they're both Zen practitioners, both students of the same teacher, Yun Yen, and yet they had these slightly different understandings, right? But that's where a lot of these Zen stories are like, we agree on most of the basics, but the slight differences make for great stories. Yes.
A couple of times I feel like the idea that of trust, you know, trusting in true nature, mm-hmm. reveal itself through trust. Mm-hmm. There are things in my mind that I'm sure are in the way of me seeing my true nature. In your experience, what are the things that maybe have arisen in your mind that you maybe have found don't warrant trust?
Yeah, in a way, that's exactly what seems to obscure our true nature is doubt, which is the opposite of trust, right? A lot of what Buddhism teaches is called these obscurations. So I even thought that this whole discussion could get into what is it that obscures the destitute son from his true nature. And so there's so many for me personally, but you know, and they fall into the classic categories of things like greed, hate, and delusion. Maybe those are the basics. All kinds of subtle and gross greed, hate, and delusion, particularly we emphasize in Zen as the source of both greed and hate. But particulars for me that still can obscure this true nature are like, for example, grasping for some kind of security. Mm. I notice like my life is changing these days. I've been in Santa Cruz for the past 10 years and planning to leave in another year. And so, it brings up some good stuff for me, like as a practice. It's kind of like when I'm just there, when play is not really thinking about the future so much, it's everything is going along smoothly. It's like I can get fooled into thinking like, it's all so easy, we just flow along like this, but it's more like leaving and not knowing what's next is that sense of security is not there, and like, what will be my future fate? It, like that worry and concern, and I notice that's just one of these days tends to like, at the time of this concern and worry, I'm losing touch with my true nature, I would say. And what it is, you could say, from as we were talking before, what we're identifying with, right? If we're identifying with the space of awareness as our true self, that one is always secure. So as I talk about it now, and I can kind of tap back into that and remember that. I feel like, it's fine, whatever happens will be totally fine. It really doesn't even matter, because this, even the big things like old age, sickness, and death, right, cannot harm this space. There are experiences that are arising and ceasing in it. But when I get into the security issue, then it's more like I'm identifying now with this separate body and mind and with its own history and karmic tendencies and so on. And I think that's the one that feels insecure. That's why I say it's nice. It's a nice practice thing, because when I start to feel really worried or insecure, it's a sign of like, Tokyo, you've forgotten who you are, actually, I would say. And when things are going smoothly and it feels like security, it's a kind of false security. I'm living in this house that's going to crumble, in this body that's going to crumble, in the sangha that's going to crumble, and like, but it feels kind of secure because it's been the same for 10 years, right? It's not secure, right? But I'm like a Buddha here. Like, it's all just going so smoothly. But actually, to shake that up a little bit is so good, because no, none of that was secure in the first place. It was all an illusion. And like, and to push the security of the separate self, which is the body and thoughts and history person, then it's kind of like a prompt. It's a little goad to be like, Kokyo, what do you remember who you are? What do you trust here? Do you trust the Zen Center and these people and this place? Or do you trust the unchanging space that it's all happening in? So thanks for the question. And but still, we can have lunch. I mean, there are these bodies appearing, so we can feed them. But don't trust what Jesus says, right? Man and woman, do not live by bread alone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.